Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
The South African government really does continue to perplex us, doesn't it, with their attitude and with the approach. But what was remarkable was that the government, the ANC, wasn't invited to Sharm el-Sheikh, the Gaza Peace Summit, which is really, really fascinating because I thought they were front and center of moral clarity in the world. I can't imagine how any peace summit, I'm saying rather facetiously, could even consider going ahead without moral clarity and guidance from the ANC. Yeah, just saying it makes it a little bit comedic. Anyway, joining us is Tony Leon. He is the former leader of the Democratic Alliance, a columnist, and he wrote a piece arguing that that South Africa's self-styled moral superpower image rang rather hollow after being snubbed at the conference that I was talking about. We wanted to chat to him and get his thoughts on it. Tony Leon, good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Howard. Thank you for having me.
I have to say that I got a tremendous amount of joy reading your article because as I was going through it, I was saying, like, great, yes. This needed to be said because really South Africa has got quite drunk on its own opinion and morality, hasn't it, in terms of Israel?
Yes, and generally in the world, Howard. Of course, Israel is a particular case on which we've chosen to burnish or attempt to burnish our very threadbare human rights credentials. And that's really what my article was about. My jumping off point in that piece that you referenced, Howard, apart from the glaring absence of South Africa at Sharm el-Sheikh on Monday, was first of all, I very carefully curated comments and participation by what you might call left-leaning politicians and governments in the world. So it was quite striking to me that Spain, for example, as I mentioned, which has joined South Africa's ICJ case, was present at Sharm. South Africa wasn't. And then, and this to me is the real, as they say in Afrikaans, vertrekbeginsel, or departure point, is I quoted two paragraphs of a statement from socialist Democrat Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont on the ceasefire in Gaza. And he quite correctly commences with a very explicit reference to the barbarity of the 7th of October and the horror show meted out to Israelis and Jews in that Hamas attack. And then he goes on to make a whole lot of other points, which I think, you know, one can argue about, but it's a lot of that's in the world. And then I cycled back to the ANC statements and indeed the Durko statements in the wake of the 7th of October. And not only was there no calling out of Hamas, the terror, the horror show, but actually, if you look at Ms. Motsabe, the ANC spokesman, basically she said the Jews had it coming to them. It was unsurprising that Hamas launched the attack. And frankly, you are not a serious player, never mind your morality or lack thereof, if you actually can't call things for what they are and then go on, quite appropriately and understandably, to say, well, Israel's response was disproportionate, or Israel exceeded the rights of self-defense, whatever. That's an absolutely appropriate argument or debate to have. But I cannot, and I think the world does not, take seriously a player which can't even identify or make explicit the trigger for the 7th of October. And that's a position SA Inc., led by Durko and the ANC, and there's no difference between the ANC and Durko on this issue and a range of others, Howard.
Why is it, in your view, that that the ANC was unable to even mutter a few words of condemnation / condolences following October the 7th?
You know, that's a very good question. It's one I interrogate in my article and at greater length in my new book, or relatively new book, being there. I think they are terrified of being called out for diluting what they see as their implacable pro-Palestine or pro-Palestinian credentials. I think that's one explanation. I think secondly, and there's kind of inferential support for this, they view Hamas, if not with sympathy, and I think people like Naledi Pandor definitely did, and I suspect Zain Dangle and various others in the top echelons of Jerko still do. But also, I think that they see Hamas as an as a revolutionary movement which wants to topple a whole range of things which are congenial to the ANC worldview. The presence of the West in an area that they regard as Arabi and therefore not open to white or, excuse me, Howard, presence, although that's how they view Israel, and let's not go into the inaccuracy of that. I also think they see themselves, or the ANC does, as the vanguard of the international campaign to eradicate or eliminate or lessen Western imperial colonialism, even capitalism itself. And so despite, look, I think a lot of people in the ANC are pretty horrified by Hamas, but given that Hamas stands against all those things, they've got to kind of, you know, bite their tongues and not be seen to be on the other side. Because once they start opposing Hamas, they seem incapable of having the flexibility or deftness of a Bernie Sanders, who very much has a lot of those views. But he has the ability, or you could call it the maturity, to actually say what things are and how this Gaza war started, which he did, and which I think even Mr. Pedro Sanchez of Spain did on the 7th of October 2 years ago. But the ANC couldn't, because I think they basically lacked the self-confidence of holding anything other than the most simplistic. And I would argue, as foreign journalists do have done to me, childish view of the world, particularly in the Middle East. You know, the other day I was having a meeting with a very senior Western diplomat based in South Africa. And the one thing that we couldn't agree, because it appears to be so, but we just don't know, because I can't get into the minds of Durko and the ANC, is does the ANC and Durko, the same thing, actually believe the Kool-Aid that they're drinking?
I've debated this as well. I've thought this through. I can't figure it out. It's impossible.
As Henry Kissinger famously said, gestures in politics can be very expensive. And I think we are paying and will continue to pay a price, whatever the moralities and the sensibility or its lack in this policy and this posture, we're going to continue paying a price for the approach we've taken. And I don't think we can complain.
Yes, when that happens.
When the bill comes due for payment.
Yeah. I'm going to come to that in just a moment. What I want to just ask you about before I get there is, immediately following October the 7th, there was that very mysterious phone call between Naledi Pandor and Hamas. Initially, it was denied completely. Then when they could no longer deny it, they again mumbled something about something. It wasn't, whatever it wasn't, we still don't know what it was. How significant was that phone call? What does that phone call tell us?
Well, you know, I don't know what was said. There were the assumptions made, and then, as you say, a pushback by Durko to say, no, we're just discussing how to get humanitarian aid into Gaza. That was the purpose of the phone call. Well, you know, the moon is made of green cheese. I mean, you can believe that if you will. I think what it did was to cement perceptions that, far from being some kind of moral arbiter, that South Africa was choosing a side, and it had chosen a side. And you know, I don't know, because none of us know, other than we weren't on the call, what Naledi Pandor said to Hamas on that phone call. What we do know, and this to me is far more important, is that if you go back to the 7th of October, in that immediate aftermath, Cyril Ramaphosa, as I mentioned, who, you know, is voluble and immediate, strangely enough, on every Israeli breach of international law, real or contested, was completely silent for a whole 9 days after the 7th of October. And it's my assumption that it was only when Israel started hitting back or fighting back and going into Gaza that he felt emboldened to say anything at all. And that was, you know, behind hidden hand and shuffled foot, as they say, Howard. So, as Pravin Gordhan, the deceased Pravin Gordhan, you say, just join up the dots.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, let's just talk about the price that South Africa is, that you alluded to. The fact that they weren't there has got to be an indication of the US's approach to South Africa in terms of the general relationship. How bad?
Well, you could also add Egypt, because it was, as with everything involving Donald Trump, very much was his show.
Yes.
But Egypt was the co-host, and so they had a say on who came and who didn't come. And, you know, LCC did not choose to invite Cyril Ramaphosa. I mean, you could say it didn't have anyone else from Africa. And one of the reasons is that outside the Gulf states and the immediate neighborhood, African countries' role in the Middle East is very small. But then that was my first thought. So whatever South Africa's, posturing might be, we're at the other end of the continent.
Mm-hmm.
But then I looked at some of the other countries that were there, you know, like Paraguay and Pakistan. Well, they don't play any role at all in the Middle East, or Japan, come to think of it. Maybe they do to some extent, but they were invited. So I think it was a signal of our irrelevance. And, you know, I made the point, and I think when you go for gesture politics, talking about price, one of the prices is that, you know, next month, in case no one's noticed, maybe the streets of Joburg and Sandton are being cleaned up as a consequence or as an anticipation. There's the G20 leadership summit in Sandton in November. But I have to say, South Africa's obtained very little purchase beyond sort of some hotel bookings and airline arrivals from its chairmanship or presidency of the G20. And that's because, you know, I don't think we're behaving like a serious and engaged player. And let's just go back to let's assume, just for the sake of debate, that many of the positions South Africa's taken during the Gaza war are correct. Okay, well, a lot of people have taken positions. But then we have these cliches. Cyril Ramaphosa mouthed them at the United Nations General Assembly last month. Ibrahim Rasool, the infamous expelled ambassador, was the one who coined the moral superpower. And they keep saying, well, let's use South Africa's lessons of negotiations and engagement, and that will be a template. But there is actually no South African plan or offer to make a constructive contribution to a wider peace in the Middle East, or even to a sustainable peace in Gaza. There's nothing. There are some cliches. There are a couple of, you know, hoary old statements about two-state solutions which they don't really practice but have a theoretical commitment to. They talk about public international law, which they're very happy to violate when it suits them, when their allies are on the wrong side of it and their enemies Absolutely. Are on the right side of it, and so on. So what I'm saying is, there's no thinking going on. There are slogans. Well, you know, it reminds me, I'm going back 40 years, to my days at the WITS SRC, Howard.
Yeah, yeah.
Where we used to pass all manner of self-important resolutions, then about apartheid and, you know, the boycott and sanctions campaign against Africa. But they didn't contribute a jot other than to the students on the WITS campus, or the leadership reflect on the SRC, to actually making a significant change. And so I think even in terms of South Africa's preferred identity of itself or image of itself, we failed in that to actually advance anything of serious consequence.
One of the concerns is that with this gesture politics, as you've called it, the price that South Africa is no doubt paying because of Durko / the ANC's approach. South Africans here back home are being ignored in terms of some real crises and being impacted internationally, which means economically quite significantly. How do South Africans hold Durko and the ANC to account, considering they're almost running rogue with our foreign policy?
Yeah, that's a difficult question to answer, although a very good one to ask. You know, if I look at my own immediate political alignment, the DA, and I was very involved last year in the negotiations leading to this GNU, the DA has played no role and is precluded from playing a role. So all the other coalition partners, it's not really a coalition, it's an amalgamation of parties doing some governing from time to time in foreign policy. So there's no agreement within government itself. It's sort of been outsourced to the ANC International Relations Department, and that's camped out at the Durko head office in Pretoria. And I even think, you know, if I compare it to the time where I was an ambassador of South Africa between 2009 and 2012, when actually South Africa had a much more serious foreign policy. It was, you know, they were taking stances at the United Nations. They supported the no-fly zone over Libya, for example, against the wishes of Russia and China at the time. And they seemed to have a genuinely independent foreign policy, which to some extent coincided with the national interest. Now, you ask the question, what can be done about it? Well, the short answer, not very helpful, is change the government, and then you might change the foreign policy. Absent of that, I think we increasingly see Howard.
Yes.
And you've had some of them on your show.
Certainly.
NGOs and civil society ploughing their own furrow. You've had the AfriForum and Solidarität visits to Washington, D.C. They seem to have a better access in a way to the White House than the South African official representatives do. You've seen increasingly businessmen, even golfers, being brought in because of the failure of South Africa's official representatives to move the needle. I'm not sure they moved the needle much after that show at the White House, but still. Yeah. So I think what you're seeing, Howard, is not just a very ineffective, a counterproductive foreign policy, but that the official channels are kaput. I might add something else, which just makes this plain, that South Africa doesn't really have a foreign policy. I said it's theoretically incoherent or simplistic, but it's got it's got very little purchase, mainly because if you look at some key places, the United States, China, Australia, South Africa doesn't even have a diplomatic head of mission. They're unfilled. I'm told, for example,
that's
Australia, which is
Australia
is one of the AUKUS nations, so it's one of the top five countries in the Indo-Pacific as far as the West is concerned. We haven't had an ambassador there for 2.5 years. Washington, D.C., 5.5 months. You know, there's a whole list. So it seems that that in basic diplomacy, you know, we can argue, as I've tried to do in our interview and in that column, about, you know, having a rather threadbare foreign policy with very dubious credentials. But actually at the execution level, it barely exists. They have unfilled posts. You try and, incidentally, never mind all contentious issues like Israel and Gaza, get hold of Durko or the officials concerned and see how long it takes you to get an email answer.
We've certainly tried and continue
and
to
it's
try.
Certainly not, and let me tell you, it's not just because they might not like Chai FM or your alignment. It's because of the overall complete dysfunctionality.
Oh, and there I was taking it personally.
No, Howard, you are very good company. I can line up a list of seriously credentialed, you know,
incredible
diplomats and others who just, you know, it's like a black hole into things are sent and nothing ever comes out at the other side.
Do you think there's been any introspection given the fact that they, just circling back to the conference that they were snubbed at or from, do you think there's any introspection? Do you think there's any form of looking inward?
Well, I would hope so. I'm not at all sure because, you know, we go back to our previous discussion or earlier discussion today. You know, are they so drunk on their own Kool-Aid, Howard, that they are incapable of looking at it with an objective, through an objective lens? And maybe there are some of them who do. Others just accept as part of the course. You know, I also have to say that in many ways, I don't know if any of you or your listeners watched that magnificent program Succession about Logan Roy, based briefly on the Murdochs, but at, you know, in the critical final episode, Brian Cox or Logan Roy turns around to his very dysfunctional children and says, "I love you, but you are not serious people." And I have to say, we don't have a serious government. We have some departments that operate, you know, with better efficiency and credibility than others. But overall, you know, if it were not for the private sector in this country, we would be a failed state. We're not a failed state because there's enough depth in the non-government sector in South Africa, from journalists to retail franchises, to actually make South Africa or keep South Africa as a going concern. But if it was entirely the state, what the ANC would like us to be, entirely state-centric, we would be a disaster zone.
Absolutely right. Tony Leon, what a fascinating conversation. That is where we do need to leave it. Thank you, as always, and thank you for putting things the way that you always do.